Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A conversation with Clint Hill. He is a veteran Secret Service agent who served and protected five presidents. He became something of a household name in 1963 when John Kennedy was assassinated. Hill was the first to get to First Lady Jackie Kennedy seconds after her husband was shot. That's just part of the history he lived is outlined in his new book, Five Presidents, My Extraordinary Journey with Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford. His job put him in the middle of some of the most important events of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Clint Hill joins me in studio. Also with us is Lisa McCubbin, the co-author of the book that I just mentioned. Lisa, I'm going to spend most of my time talking with Clint, if you don't mind. But if you've got something to say, chime in.
Okay. Sure will. Thank you.
Great to have you with us, Clint. Nice to have you with
Thank
us.
Thank you very much. Pleasure being here.
I saw a tweet that you sent out this morning, and this is where I want to start. This is the 22nd anniversary of Jackie Kennedy's death. I'm sure it brings back many memories for you. Reflect on that for a moment.
Well, it really does. It happens to be a day also that 22 years ago for when Mrs. Kennedy died, and 42 years ago my mother died on this same day. So it has a special significance to me. Mrs. Kennedy was a wonderful lady. I had the utmost respect for her, and we got along very well. We had a wonderful relationship during the time that I was with her. And they had me stay with her for 1 year after the assassination, so I got to know her very, very well. She was a person who loved her privacy, and I tried to provide that to her as much as possible. And during the time that she was at the White House, we were somewhat successful in doing that, and she was very grateful for my doing that for her.
Do you think the public fully understood and appreciated Jackie Kennedy for who she was?
No, not really. I don't believe so. They didn't realize, I don't think, how intelligent she was or how devoted she was to the children and to her husband, the president. They didn't realize how much of an athlete she was either. She was extremely a capable athlete who was an expert horsewoman, loved to water ski, play golf, play tennis. Everything that was active like that, she was a master of it. She really enjoyed it and spent as much time as possible to do that kind of thing.
And the fact that she was fluent in French and Spanish was a pretty good thing for her husband, wasn't it?
Well, it was very beneficial, French, Spanish, and Italian, by the way. And that was very helpful as they went through the administration, the years that they spent, whether in France or she visiting Italy. It was very helpful.
You know, one of the things in your book that I wanted to question you about was the Aristotle Onassis connection. The first time that she was going abroad to Greece, I guess it was, where her husband said, by all means, do not cross paths with Aristotle Onassis. A year or two later, she was going back in the same direction and going to spend some time on his yacht. What happened in the intervening years, do you know?
Well, initially, the visit was in 1961, the first time. She had met Onassis, as had the president, when he was a senator. They'd met him in Monaco. And now it was 1961, and she was a guest in Greece of Prime Minister Mrs. Karaman Liss. And so I was to do the advance, go there and set up this trip. And the president called me into the office, and he asked me if that was what I was assigned to do, and I said yes. And he said then, please, while she's there, do not let her cross paths with Aristotle Onassis. I did not know why he made that statement. But an agent friend of mine who was going to go with me to Athens was of Greek descent. His uncle was the chief of police in Athens. So we did some checking, and we found that Onassis had been fined $7 million or something like that by the United States government for something to do with the use of some ships that he had acquired from the United States. And the belief was that the president issued that declaration because he didn't think it would be in the best interest to have a photograph taken of the two of them, Onassis and Mrs. Kennedy, when there was a big congressional election coming up in 1962. So that was our belief. Then in 1963, she and the president lost their young son, Patrick Bouvier Kennedy, who died just 2 days after he was born. She was very depressed, as was he. But the thought was, based on a recommendation from her sister, that she might want to go away for a while just to get away from it, away from everything for a while. And the president agreed. And her sister was a friend of Onassis. And he indicated, she indicated to Mrs. Kennedy that Onassis would welcome them aboard his ship, the Christina, to be used as a cruise ship in the Mediterranean. And she willingly accepted it, and the president encouraged her to go. His staff was not so positive about it. They really didn't think it was a good idea. But he insisted that she be permitted to go. And so she and I and one other agent, Paul Landis, went aboard the Christina.
That must have been quite some vessel.
It was. We had a crew of 48, and there were only 10 passengers on board. But the passengers, it was kind of a nice mix. It was Franklin D. Roosevelt Jr. and his wife, two of Aristotle Onassis' sisters, Princess Irina Galitzine from Italy and her husband, and an actor from Greece and his wife. So, and then Mrs. Kennedy's sister and her husband, Prince Stanislaus Radziwill. So it was a nice mix.
Yeah, it sounds like it must have been a fun voyage. What sort of a code of silence do Secret Service agents have with regard to the people they're protecting?
Well, during the course of the time that they're protecting an individual, we don't discuss anything with anybody outside the Secret Service as to the activities of the president. And I am one of those that did not do that. Now that it's been some almost 50 years since since I retired. I retired in 1975, and that's 41 years ago. Mm. So the information I have revealed in the book in no way jeopardizes current Secret Service procedures. And in fact, I have provided books to the Secret Service for their perusal and ask them to come back with any critical analysis, and so far it's all been good.
You know, I asked that question because I'm sure you're asked a lot about President Kennedy's personal life, aside from the marriage, his romantic entanglements. How do you handle that?
Well, you know, we were there not to judge him. Mm-hmm. We were there to secure the area around him and him, and to keep him safe. And so, we weren't his moral judges. If he wanted to do anything, that was up to him, not up to us. I have no personal knowledge that anything like that ever happened. And I was with Mrs. Kennedy most of the time.
Right.
But there were a great many times when he was with us or we were together. And so, but I never saw anything that would indicate that the information that I've heard is actually true.
Did that information that you've heard come as a surprise to you, or?
Well, I have heard it for so long, I don't think it was really a surprise, but it just was something that I never saw and never witnessed. As long as I didn't witness it, I didn't believe it.
Sure. You know, there a lot of people have been confused over the years with regard to what Jackie Kennedy was doing in those seconds after her husband was shot. Some people thought she was trying to get out of that car. Who could blame her if, in fact, that's what she was trying to do? You were right there. You were a foot or two away from her. What was she doing?
She was trying to retrieve some of the material that had erupted out of the president's skull. When the president was shot in the head, the entry point was lower in the head, and his head was in such a position it was turned down and to the left. And it was right against her face. She was within 2-3 inches of the entry point of the that particular bullet. But when the bullet erupted out of the skull, it blew out a portion of the skull, and the scalp and a portion of the skull formed a flap that went forward, and then all this material came out. So she went up on the trunk trying to grab some of that material. Now, when I got up on the trunk on the back of the car to try and shield she and the president to prevent anything further from happening, she didn't even realize I was there. At least that's what she says and said it to the Warren Commission. And I, at that time, just barely nudged her back into the seat. It wasn't with a great deal of effort at all. Then when I did that, the president's body fell to his left with his head in her lap. But she was not trying to escape the car as far as I was concerned. She was simply trying to retrieve some of the material that had erupted from the president's skull.
Lisa McCubbin, can you possibly imagine being in a situation like that?
Not at all. And, you know, I've heard him tell this story hundreds of times. What's amazing, actually, is, You know, when I first met Clint in 2009, he told me he had not talked about that day to anyone other than the Warren Commission and briefly to Mike Wallace in 1975 on 60 Minutes. As I've watched him grow over the past 6 years, he's able now to talk about it objectively. But at first, it was extremely painful.
I got that very clearly from the book. And that's why I wanted to bring you in at this particular point, because, Clint, quite frankly, I'm reluctant to go much farther with the Kennedy assassination, given the fact that you suffered PTSD as a result of that incident for decades.
Yeah, we didn't know that there was a name to it. It wasn't given until recent years. But yes, that's what I was going through, was PTSD. But I'm able now to look at the situation objectively and talk about it. And it actually is cathartic for me to do so.
Well, okay. Well, you've done it as far as we're concerned for this program, and I'm sure you'll be asked about it again tonight. I'll remind our audience that you're going to be appearing at the Missouri History Museum talking about your book and signing it, Five Presidents. That's not at 7 o'clock. We'll have further information on our website. Is it fair for me to ask you if, of the five presidents you covered, you had a favorite?
It's fair for you to ask. I really did not. And we looked at it as we tried not to get too personally involved with the individual. You don't want a real personal connection. We had more of a personal connection, perhaps, with John F. Kennedy because of his age. And when they'd come up to Hyannisport, his brothers would want to play touch football, and they always enlisted one or two of us to participate with them. So it got somewhat personal. But we were really more involved in whoever the occupant of the office of the president was. We really didn't care if they were Republican, Democrat, white, black, male, female. That didn't matter. Whoever happened to be the occupant, that was the individual we were interested in.
Well, I want to pick up on that point. We have to take a break. We'll do that now and come back and continue our conversation with Clint Hill. He is the author of Five Presidents, My Extraordinary Journey with Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford. Also with us in studio is Lisa McCubbin, his co-author of the book. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to Clint Hill, and also with us in studio is his co-author of his book, Lisa McCubbin. Clint, let me come back to the presidents. I understand what you're saying with regard to being kind of impartial about all of them, but I did sense in reading the book that that maybe Richard Nixon had a special place because you mentioned on several occasions you thought that they were a little bit unsavory, untoward in some of their acts.
Well, maybe he created a problem in my mind because of some of the things that he did that were really against everybody's advice. And that created problems. I'll just give you one example where during his administration, there were massive anti-war demonstrations, and they were all in Washington, or they at least started there. And on one occasion, we anticipated there were going to be hundreds of thousands of demonstrators in the city. So we, together with the military and the local Metropolitan Police in Washington, the Park Police, decided to ring the White House perimeter with buses, bumper to bumper, so we'd form a wall all the way around the entire complex. About 4:30 in the morning, he decides he wants to go down to the Lincoln Memorial. The midnight shift is working, and so they bring his car, and they take him down there, and he has his valet with him, and then a doctor came along. Now, he went out through that perimeter down to the Lincoln Memorial where all these students were. And he went down there and he sat down and they found out that one group was from Syracuse University. And so he started talking to them about the Syracuse football team. They had no interest at all in discussing their football team. They were there anti-Nixon, anti-war. That's the only thing they had in their minds. It took a while to get he and his valet out of there, and they finally got him back in the car. And then that wasn't enough. He then wanted to go up to the U.S. Capitol, show his valet his former House seat, and then first his Senate seat, and then that they couldn't get in because it was locked. So then he went over to the House side of the Capitol. There was a maintenance person there, let him in. They went into the chamber. He insisted that his valet go up and sit in the speaker's chair and address an empty room except for President Nixon. And that kind of thing just irritated me. And so I guess I had that sense that this is nonsensical.
He was not nearly as impulsive as Lyndon Johnson, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But first, staying with Nixon, there are a couple of things that you had indicated with regard to him. One of was you suggested that he actually threw Spiro Agnew under the bus. The suggestion was that somehow the Nixon people leaked some of the things that ultimately brought Agnew down.
Well, the relationship deteriorated from the day that they took the oath of offices together, from January 20th, 1969. At first, Agnew was given an office within the West Wing of the White House. That didn't last long because none of the people that worked in the White House wanted anything to do with Agnew. They all were dedicated and loyal to Nixon. And so Agnew went back over to the executive office building where all vice presidents have always had an office. And then he was the point man, really, for all the negative speeches that Nixon didn't make himself. He had Agnew go out and do that kind of thing for him. And then it got to the point where it became obvious that they were looking around in 1972 for a replacement. And so I do think that there was some indication that they thought that this would be a good way to get rid of him. And I don't know exactly what the vice president did while he was governor or even while he was sitting in the office in the vice president's offices. He eventually did plead guilty, and I felt sorry for his wife, Judy, who was a wonderful lady. In fact, she called me up about a week after the vice president pled guilty and asked if I could explain to her exactly what had happened. Mm-hmm. And I had a very difficult time doing that.
Another issue with regard to Mr. Nixon that you relate in your book is that he apparently tried to get a Secret Service agent put with Teddy Kennedy at one point to spy on Kennedy, which showed, in my mind, a tendency on Mr. Nixon's part to spy on other people.
Well, that's very true, and that's exactly what he tried to do. Mm-hmm. The request came from the presidential assistant initially to me because I, at that time, was the assistant director, controlled the people on these kind of details. And he called me. His name was Alexander Butterfield. And he wanted us to place a certain agent on that detail with Teddy Kennedy. I told him we had the people there that we wanted there, and that was not necessary. He seemed to reluctantly accept that, but then he apparently turned around and called the Secretary of the Treasury's office, because we were at that time part of the Treasury. And the next thing I knew, I got a telephone call from the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury telling me that this is what the White House wanted done, and this is what was going to be done. And so we just had to go ahead and do something. And so I went next door to the Assistant Director for Criminal Investigations Office, because this particular agent was in a field office, and they controlled him. And they put the word down to him that if he leaked any information, his career was through. And as far as we could determine later on, he never did. They never learned anything that they wanted to know.
There's an irony here because, as I remember it, it was Butterfield who told the world that Nixon had the White House tapes going.
That's correct. Alex made that right. He made that statement in front of the Warren Commission, and
that changed everything. It was not the Warren Commission.
The
Watergate.
Watergate Committee.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's quite all right. There is so much history that you've been a part of. It's a wonder you can keep any of it straight.
It does get confusing to me at times.
Yeah, let me get back to LBJ because we talked a moment ago about being impulsive. I've never seen anything like what this guy was doing. I mean, he'd take off on a trip for one part of the world and say, by the way, on my way back, I want to stop off and see the Pope. Just like that.
He was very unpredictable. He always thought that surprise was his best defense and best way to protect himself. And so he would give everybody as little notice as possible, and sometimes no notice at all. And it made it very difficult. But then at times he was just normal. But there were those unpredictable trips that really caused us concern.
He was, we've done a number of programs related to things that have been written about him, and most recently concerning his wife, Lady Bird. And I think a lot of people never quite understood what she was and who she was and what an impact she had on that presidency.
Oh, there's no question. She was quite a lady, very intelligent. And he would give somebody what we call the Johnson treatment. And when he was finished, if Lady Bird happened to be around, when the president walked away, she would walk over and start to apologize and tell the individual who had just been chewed out unmercifully that Lyndon really didn't mean it, that it was just the way of his venting, and that he really thought that the individual was a wonderful person and doing a wonderful job. And she was the smoother type person.
And smart.
Very smart.
And very sharp in terms of business.
Very good businesswoman.
What about some of the other wives? I mean, to most of the people listening now, Mamie Eisenhower, for instance, is probably a memory that they don't even have. And we don't hear much about her. What was your take on Mamie Eisenhower?
Well, she was very reserved. She didn't do much. She just supported her husband. And President Eisenhower, she had been with him through the wars when he was a general, and she really just took care of, make sure that everything was okay for who she referred to as the general.
This was the 50s, after all, and wives and women played a somewhat different role than they're playing in the world today. Lisa, you're shaking your head over there. Give me your quick take on that, how that's changed.
Well, it's so funny because Clint, when he was first assigned to Jacqueline Kennedy, you know, he didn't want that assignment because he had seen how the agents were with Mamie Eisenhower. He said, you know, they got to go to canasta games and tea parties, sure, and he didn't want any part of that.
Well, that changed, because of, particularly with Jackie, because of your fondness for her.
Well, it was a big change because of her activity level. She was involved in everything. And at the White House, she was involved in redoing the interior of the White House so that it became more or less an American representative museum of American things. And that had never been done before, and it has remained that way ever since.
What about Pat Nixon? I tend to think of her as rather pathetic, given what she had to go through during particularly the last years.
I think all of us, and even the staff, I think, felt very sorry for her.
Yeah.
Because she was really in the background so far. It was like they didn't have that much to do with each other. It appeared that way anyway. And I personally thought it was terrible the way that she actually was treated by the president, that he didn't treat her in a manner that she deserved.
Well, here we go again. I mean, you're not reluctant to kind of cast an elbow his way.
Well, some of the things he did just were way beyond what anything I'd ever seen before. I'll give you an example. When they'd have a state dinner, after a state dinner's over, the president usually greets the people and talks to them, various congressmen and businessmen and all that kind of thing. Nixon put the word out to the staff, to Butterfield specifically, and to his military aide, that when a state dinner is done, I don't want to talk to any more than five people. And I don't have to talk to congressmen or senators, just five people, and I'll tell you which five. Give me a list of who's going to be there. But tell everybody else, tell the aides, I'll show all the other people away. I mean, it was just not the normal, and I couldn't understand why.
A different type altogether, I gather, watching from afar, was Betty Ford.
Yes, and she was a wonderful lady. But she, you know, they were thrust onto the office of the presidency, and not something they sought. They lived in a small house over in Alexandria, Virginia. And when they came into the vice presidency, that was a big step up from what they had been as a member of the Congress. And then to all of a sudden find out that they were going to be the president, that was a major step. And it was difficult for her, I think. But she handled it fairly well and recovered. And she went through a lot. She had breast cancer. She was a recovering alcoholic. So she had a lot of problems that she had to personally deal with. And she managed to do that very well. And I think she set an example of what you can do after you've recovered from some things like that.
You know, and I think back to the years that you were with the agency, you know, starting with Eisenhower and the U-2 incident, then going to Kennedy, the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the assassination and the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, and the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia, if you will, the convention in Chicago, then Watergate. My God, you know, when you think back on these times, what comes into focus most clearly?
Well, the one thing that I've always said is that anybody that raises their right hand and takes that oath of office better be prepared for a major challenge, because they're going to have it. It's coming. You won't know about it on the day you're sworn in, but in a few days or a few months, you're going to be really challenged in a major way, and you better be able to handle it, because that's going to determine how your presidency turns out. It was a real tough job to see some of these people that they met well, and it didn't turn out the way they had intended, and it caused them, for example, in Johnson's case, the Vietnam War was what caused him to have to leave office. It drove him from office. Kennedy, when he started out, the first thing he did was make a big mistake with the Bay of Pigs. He fortunately recovered in 1962 with the Cuban Missile Crisis. So that's really what his legacy is, that his presidency at that point was on the positive side. So all these things, whoever takes that oath of office next January has got a major problem in their hands, no matter what they think now. And I know they make all kinds of promises, that things they can do, but they better be aware that they can't do it alone. They need the backing of the Congress.
How would you like to be with the Secret Service now and covering Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton?
Well, if they'd take me back, I'd start tomorrow morning, but I think it would be kind of difficult.
Do you think one of the questions I'm being asked to ask you here is, if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency and Bill Clinton becomes first man, or whatever they're going to call him, if it in fact happens, what sort of challenges do you think that would present?
Well, he'll be the first spouse, I guess they'd call him. I don't know. I hadn't thought about it too much, but it's not going to be any different than, because we have a detail with him right now, as a matter of fact, since he's a former president.
Sure.
And one with her. And so I don't think that will create a problem for the Secret Service.
Right. One other thing I want to talk to you about before we have to wrap this up. You were not there physically, but you were in the vicinity when Elvis Presley showed up at the White House. And I'm not sure everybody knows that story, but he came in wanting to be deputized.
Elvis shows up one day unannounced at the Northwest Gate. Now, we have lots of people that do that. They think they can just walk in and see the president. He realized that he could not at that time, because he was told he couldn't go in. So he had a letter that he had written, and he had to give it to the officer. The officer turned it over to a member of the president's next staff. They realized that this was a great publicity opportunity. So they contacted Elvis and had him come over for an appointment with Nixon. His intention was to become a federal agent. He felt that he could deal with the narcotics problem better than anybody else, because he knew all these young people were his fans. So they did give him a honorary Federal Bureau of Narcotics badge. It had no authority whatsoever. I mean, you give it to whoever you want to, but it doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. But he went away a happy man in his purple velvet suit.
That's just one of the stories that is recounted in Clint Hill's book, Five Presidents, My Extraordinary Journey with Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford, co-written by Lisa McCubbin, who's been with us in studio. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Lisa, great to meet you.
Thank you.
And Clint Hill, congratulations to you on a wonderful career and a wonderful life.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being here.
And it's a pleasure reading your book, and I heartily recommend it. A reminder that Clint will be appearing at the Missouri History Museum talking about and signing his book, Five Presidents, tonight. That's happening at 7 o'clock. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.